I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
2 minutes, yes.
May it please the court, Christopher Small appearing on behalf of Christopher Moore, the appellant in this case. There are two issues before the court in this case. The first is whether or not Mr. Moore's consent to entry was valid considering the lack of failure warnings. Second is whether or not, in this case, the officer's search of Mr. Moore's home falls under one of the exceptions to the warrant requirement.
Let's consider the first, if you will.
Certainly.
And we'll get to Ferrier later. As you know, we discussed these cases the afternoon prior to oral arguments. So my questions are based on this. With respect to the emergency aid exception, which is the basis upon which the state supports the warrantless entry here, number four of the Schultz factors is that there is an imminent threat of substantial injury to persons or property. My question is this. Do the unchallenged findings of fact support that, and if not, why not?
I don't believe they do, and I think if you look to Schultz, one of the requirements is, I guess, even if it is a subjective belief of the officers, that subjective belief has to be based on the facts at hand.
Well, let's be very careful. There are six factors. The right. One that I'm asking about is not the subjective belief.
Number four.
Number one is what you conceded below applies here, and you've also conceded on appeal. So I'm looking at number four exclusively.
Understood. But my point is I don't think that there was any evidence of an imminent threat of substantial injury to a person in this case. We have an anonymous phone call, and that's pretty much it. We have the officers show up to the door. There's no signs of any struggle. There's no evidence whatsoever that any incident has occurred. They knock on the door. Mr. Moore opens it. There's no information to suggest any delay. There's no information related to his demeanor. There's no information related to any physical marks or observations of the officer. The kids are sitting on the couch watching television. There's nothing untoward about the house. So all we have is an anonymous phone call, and I think that's important, too, because it wasn't the victim that made the alleged victim in this case that made the call. It was the third party.
So I take it that with respect to your position on appeal, is that the failure to substantiate that conclusion makes the whole thing fall?
Well, I think the lack of information and evidence in this case fails with regard to the first criteria. It also fails with regard to the fourth criteria.
But my question is, even if all the other criteria are fulfilled, your position is that since Schultz requires all of these elements to be satisfied, the lack of this one, at minimum, should support a reversal.
Certainly.
Okay.
I do believe that.
With respect to Ferrier, that was not raised below, was it?
That was not raised below?
Yes, at the trial court, at the 3-6 hearing.
No, it was not.
Okay. So why should we consider Ferrier warnings on appeal?
Well, it wasn't raised, I guess, because I think the state has attempted to make it an issue in their reply, and that because Mr. Moore allowed the officers into the home, that then they gave carte blanche for them to do whatever they wanted.
So your point, I take it from your response just now, is that this is not necessarily an acquiescence, as in Schultz, because he did say come in response to their question as to whether they could come in to talk.
Correct. I'm not disputing that the record reflects Mr. Moore said sure when they asked if they could come in. I think the record, though, also reflects there were two officers, and one of the officers immediately began searching the home. When the officer encountered a locked door, they asked if they could go in. He said no. I think.
Okay. I have one other question.
Sure.
With respect to the search of the home, they've characterized, or the findings characterize this as a protective sweep. What's that mean in the context that we have here?
Your Honor, I think they received an anonymous domestic violence phone call, and they were going into the house to see if anyone was there. That's what I think they mean by protective sweep.
Okay.
So is it your position then that if the police officers are going in because they have a domestic violence call, okay, well, first question is, you emphasize that it's an anonymous phone call, but in the context of checking out a domestic violence call, does that really matter? I mean, we don't have Aguilar Spinelli here, right?
I, I think in this context it matters because there was absolutely no other evidence that, that substantiated the phone call. I think if the officers would have...
Should they have not... So they just go and they knock on the door and nothing appears amiss, so then they just leave?
Well, I mean, anonymous phone calls happen all the time for all kinds of different reasons. That's why the officers are required to substantiate the information that they're provided. If they wanted to go in at that time, they could have retreated and gotten a warrant based on the information they had. They could have taken an extra 5 minutes and contacted the anonymous caller. They could have attempted to call the victim. They could have done many, many different things. They could have asked Mr. Moore if they could search the home. With consent, I don't know if we'd be here today, but I think that's
okay. So the trial court findings seem to make much of the officers talked about how well trained they were and everything. And is it your understanding then that this is the training that they are given, that as soon as they get a domestic violence call of any kind, anonymous or not, that the thing to do is to thoroughly investigate it, without hesitation?
Well, I would hope that their training doesn't include warrantless searches of homes without any...
Okay, but let's... They get in. Okay, here's the thing. They're crossing the threshold at the invitation of your client, Mr. Moore, and they come in and talk. And everything seems fine. The children are unruffled. The conversation is calm. There's no noise. There's no visible marks of struggle or anything like that.
Sure.
Nevertheless, they've heard that there's a domestic violence incident possibly. So the officer undertakes what is described in the record as a protective sweep, which I take to mean, and perhaps I have the wrong understanding of it, is but that he goes down the hall to look around to see if there's anybody like hiding around the corner or within the possibility of somehow bursting forth with a weapon or something like that. Is that they shouldn't do that? They shouldn't do a protective sweep?
I think they have to have some basis for believing that there's anyone around, that there's a fear of safety. In any of the cases that exist on these issues, there are always some other factors. For example, State v. Johnson, the victim's locked in the bathroom, defendant has a cut on his wrist, slow to answer questions about the location of the victim. State v. Raines, history of domestic violence calls, which does not exist in this case. Familiar with defendant's violent tendencies, familiar with history of victim understating events. State v. Lynn, person called 911 and hung up, return calls met busy, defendant admitted to assaulting the victim, defendant packing cars if ready to leave.
Okay. So the officer does a protective sweep. Does the record show what actually happens then? The findings seem to blur it all together. I mean, at some point...
I believe
it does. What happens during the protective sweep? Does he find one plant or...
I believe during the protective sweep, the officer sees...
You may answer.
The officer sees one plant in the bathroom, I believe. Gets to a bedroom door that is locked. Asks if Mr. Moore will open it. He says no. He kicks in the door. Many plants. The sweep resumes.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Charles Blackman, a deputy prosecuting attorney with Snohomish County. I'm asking that the judgment and sentence below be affirmed, and specifically that the trial court's finding that the entry into the home, and to the extent it's before you, the subsequent search, were lawful. I guess I'd start out by answering the court's question about how is factor number four substantiated, the imminent harm. When officers came to the threshold, they knew five things, and then they found out a sixth when the defendant opened the door. The five things were that a third party identified as a neighbor had called. That named the defendant and named the alleged victim. The call spoke of a physical assault. I'll come back to that in a minute.
You said a neighbor of what? Neighbor? I just don't recall the word neighbor appearing in what I've seen.
There was a discussion in the testimony. Let me find the...
We're looking at the written findings of fact and conclusion.
It wasn't in the written findings of fact. There was testimony that the caller was a neighbor.
A neighbor of whom?
Doesn't say.
Everybody's a neighbor, I guess.
Well, I think in the context of not only was there a specific location indicated, but the police were told by dispatch the third party had been contacted by the victim. They knew those five things. There's other stuff they learned later once they were in the residence, but they knew those five things. And I think in that context, if it's a neighbor who was contacted by a victim, could not one assume that neighbor meant neighbor of the victim that had contacted the reporting party? It's in there in the testimony, but Your Honor is right that it's not a it wasn't set forth in the findings.
Well, it's probably not a major point. So.
But my question is, how does that fulfill the criterion? Imminent threat of substantial injury to persons or property. I mean, the whole purpose of this inquiry is that we're looking at a narrow exception to a requirement of a warrant. And it seems to me that those words have meaning. So why does what you just told us factually, which is unchallenged, constitute a determination that there's an imminent threat of substantial injury to persons?
Because it spoke of a physical assault, as distinguished in Schultz, which gave us the additional three standards. In Schultz, the issue was a verbal altercation. That's what the call was about. And then when they got there, when police got there, there was more verbal that they could hear.
Now,
and
how
then,
do you know that there was a physical confrontation at the threshold? And for purposes of my question, let's assume that we have what the officers knew and when they knew it at the threshold and what they may have learned after crossing that threshold. So where in the findings do we have evidence of an imminent threat of substantial injury to person at the threshold?
That the call was about a physical assault.
Okay.
And if that weren't there, I think that makes the difference. What they then learned at the threshold was the defendant identified himself as one of the two named parties. So that's the sixth thing that they know. And at that point, they ask him, can we come in and talk? And he said, sure.
Now, what I see in the findings here, just to back you up about there was a physical assault, says the information provided by dispatch to law enforcement was for a specific address and specific individuals involved in the so for a physical domestic. That's what you're relying on for the fact that there was imminent harm, the words physical domestic.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah, physical has to mean something. It's not just verbal, which was what we were dealing with in Schultz. Since I'm talking about Schultz, I'll just raise this right now. The other big difference, very big difference between this case and Schultz, is in Schultz, having gotten an allegation of a verbal altercation and then hearing a verbal altercation, the police at the threshold, when Ms. Schultz said, oh, there's no guy here, they said, come on, we heard him. And then Mr. Robertson comes forward. At that point, you take a snapshot, and all you have is verbal altercation, and you have both parties right there in the view of the officers, and neither one is hurt, and neither one is acting hurt. Here, we don't have Shiloh Brockman. We don't know where she is. She's not there, and that's the big difference, is and they've got to ascertain where is she and is she okay, and that's a huge difference.
Well, let me ask you a question. The trial judge did not make findings about the time delay between the dispatch call to the officers, that first call dispatching the officers, and Bill Grant's phone call. How much time elapsed?
I don't think we know. I looked for that. I looked for it in the findings, and I looked for it in the testimony.
The eminency? I mean, how eminent does it have to be? Isn't it imminent mean it's going to happen right away? It happened right away.
Well, I would certainly think it contemplates a response within minutes.
What was the imminency here? I'm struggling with that. Because, you know, Washington's constitutional principles are even more stringent than federal, and the home is sacrosanct. So I'm struggling to determine what was imminent about this.
I can only point that there was certainly no allegation of delay, and the officers indicated that they got this call and they went to the residence, then I believe Officer Seong, if I'm pronouncing it right, got there first, but waited for Officer Vermeulen to get there because domestic violence or alleged domestic violence situations can be volatile, and he didn't want to go in alone.
There were alternatives less intrusive, like asking the defendant to step outside and talk to them on the porch, while one officer could have asked, can I go inside? He allowed the officer to go inside. They could have called out for Ms. Brockman, didn't do that. I'm struggling with this factor.
She wasn't there, so had they called out, had they asked him to step outside?
They didn't know it at the time.
Correct, but they sure didn't see her.
Well, were they looking for her?
Yeah, well, that was the testimony, is that they were they wanted to ascertain, as in any response on a domestic violence call, is everyone safe?
Why not get a warrant?
Well, it certainly defeats the imminence. We'd never have imminent harm then, would we? Because even a telephonic warrant is going to take a while. So why would we even have that factor to be met if there was a warrant requirement?
Your position then amounts to this, though, that if the police get an anonymous call reporting a physical domestic, they may go into a house and kick doors down.
No, because this call wasn't anonymous. This call, we had at least a first name. We had a number. They were ultimately able to contact the person. So, and it was odd that he used a different name, and police were familiar with him from...
What they knew at the time is that it was an anonymous call.
I don't recall that in the record, is that they knew they had a reporting party who was a neighbor.
I see.
And I don't think the assertion that the call was anonymous, we can talk about other parts of the call, but is borne out by the record or by the findings.
Well, I guess what I'm asking sort of a more general question in terms of general principles, what the police can know. If a call comes in reporting, and the person claims to have a name, and it says, this is Bill Grant, and I've been called by somebody I know, and she says that there's a physical, she's being beaten up. That maybe that's the way it comes through, is a physical domestic, okay. The police can go to that house and kick the doors down. Because I have first thought that there's like two stages here. First they go in and they get permission to come in, and then somebody does a protective sweep. Okay, that's maybe a little bit less than a full-blown search. Then at some point they kick the doors down, and also at some point they get a report that fortifies the idea that there's a physical, that there's actually some language used.
And I think really the record...
being beaten up, and somehow I thought you were arguing that that strengthened their position to kick the doors down, but it isn't clear to me that they kicked the doors down after they got the second piece of information.
I thought that was borne out by the record, is that they were still doing the protective sweep, and they got the additional information both from the defendant and from dispatch.
In the findings of fact is not particularly illuminating.
No, it's not. And so I looked at the transcript, and it certainly looked like, and I can submit an additional statement of facts, but that they did not kick down the doors of the locked rooms until after they had the additional information.
I have one other question before you sit down. The written findings say that the officers were concerned about domestic violence, and I don't think there's any dispute here. But it says that it was the concern that led officers, domestic violence, to conduct a protective sweep of the residence and to enter locked rooms. My understanding of a protective sweep, and I'm not a police authority, is that you're doing it for the purpose of making sure that you don't get shot. Is there something beyond that that justifies a protective sweep?
I believe there is that there also, and certainly there was a testimony here, that they were looking for Ms. Brockman, and that doesn't permit police to open drawers, for example, but you can look anywhere where a person could be hiding or could be lying or could be injured, and that includes the locked doors.
Okay, thank you.
And I see my time is up. I never addressed consent. I think that's before the court also as an alternate basis to affirm the initial entry because it's supported by the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may briefly address one of the facts that the state brought up. There is no information in the record that the caller was a neighbor, either in the findings of fact or in the record itself, because that just simply wasn't true. And to speak about the anonymity of the phone call, I don't have the cases on the tip of my tongue, but I know case law exists that basically says phone calls are considered anonymous unless there is some identifying information and some verifiable facts that point to the veracity of the caller. And the whole reason that that's the case is for cases just like this. Mr. Grant, who turned out to be somebody different, calls and sends the police over to Mr. Moore's house. We don't know anything about the relationship between Mr. Moore, Ms. Brockman, and the caller, but that's the reason that the police officers are required to verify the information that they're provided before they go in and kick down doors.
So you're saying that in a domestic violence case where a third party observes or learns information about a domestic violence going on or recently having occurred, that they have to identify themselves, the officers, law enforcement have to verify that information before officers can even are permitted to go on the...
So in this case, for example, it wasn't Mr. Grant didn't see anything. He received a phone call from Ms. Brockman, allegedly. He called the officers and reported this incident.
Well, we need to stick to what the findings were.
I believe those are the findings. They may not be, and if they're not, that's okay.
He learned something directly from the alleged victim.
What I'm saying is the police need to see something that verifies the report.
Well,
and
can't
in this
go
case,
out at
they
all.
Even when they're at the house, they didn't observe any evidence at all of
to
domestic.
To go out there to investigate, they can't go out. Is that what you're saying?
No. They certainly should go and investigate. But in all the other cases that are referenced, there's always some corroborating evidence when they get to the residence. The door is ajar. They hear yelling, as in Schultz. They see marks on the alleged defendant. The person is packing up to leave the house. There's a victim in the bathroom that's crying.
I understand your point. Thank you.
Thank you,
counsel. The next matter is Watts versus